For proper thieves? The corners of her beautiful mouth curled, and for a moment he was afraid she would laugh at him. But she simply shook her head and drew even nearer. Her body was the barest breadth from his now. The need to close that scrap of distance was maddening.
The first day you showed up at my house for this proper courtship, I would have cornered you in the pantry, she said. But please, tell me more about Fjärden girls.
They speak quietly. They don't engage in flirtations with every single man they meet.
I flirt with the women, too.
I think you'd flirt with a date palm if it would pay you any attention.
If I flirted with a plant, you can bet it would stand up and take notice.
Are you jealous?
All the time.
I'm glad. What are you looking at, Matthias?
The low thrum of her voice vibrated straight through him. He kept his eyes on the ceiling, whispering softly. Nothing.
Matthias, are you praying?
Possibly.
For restraint,
she said sweetly. You really are a witch.
I'm not proper, Matthias.
I am aware of this. Miserably, keenly, hungrily aware.
And I'm sorry to inform you. But you're not proper either.
His gaze dropped to her now.
How many rules have you broken since you met me? How many laws?
They won't be the last. Nothing about us will ever be proper, she said. She tilted her face up to his. So close now, it was as if they were already touching.
Not the way we met, not the life we lead, and not the way we kiss.
She went up on tiptoe, and, that easily, her mouth was against his. It was barely a kiss, just a quick, startling press of her lips. Before she could even think of moving away, he had hold of her. He knew he was probably doing everything wrong, but he couldn't bring himself to worry, because she was in his arms. Her lips were parting, her hands were twining around his neck, and sweet gel, her tongue was in his mouth. No wonder Fjärdens were so cautious about courtship. If Matthias could be kissing Nina, feeling her nip at his lip with her clever teeth, feel her body fitted against his own, hear her release that little sigh in the back of her throat, why would he ever bother doing anything else? Why would anyone?
Matthias,
Nina said breathlessly. And then they were kissing again. She was sweet as the first rain, lush as new meadows. His hands curled along her back, tracing her shape, the line of her spine, the emphatic flare of her hips.
Matthias,
she said more insistently, pulling away. He opened his eyes, certain he'd made some horrible mistake. Nina was biting her lower lip. It was pink and swollen. She was smiling, and her eyes sparkled. Did I do something wrong?
Not at all, you glorious bupink. But...
Zoya cleared her throat.
I'm glad you two found a way to spend the time while you waited.
Her expression was pure disgust, but next to her, Jenya looked like she was about to burst with glee.
Perhaps you should put me down?
Suggested Nina. Reality crashed in on Matthias, the guard's knowing looks, Zoya and Jenya in the doorway, and the fact that, in the course of kissing Nina Zenik with a year's worth of pent-up desire, he had lifted her clear off her feet. A tide of embarrassment flooded through him. What Fjärden did such a thing? Gently he released his hold on her magnificent thighs and let her slide to the ground.
Shameless,
Nina whispered, and he felt his cheeks go red. Zoya rolled her eyes.
We're making a deal with a pair of love-struck teenagers.
Matthias felt another wave of heat in his face, but Nina just adjusted her wig and said,
So you'll accept our help?
It took them a short time to work out the logistics of how the night would go. Since it might not be safe for Nina to return to the tavern once she had the information on where and when to board Vanek's ship, she would get a message to the embassy, probably via Inej, since the Wraith could come and go without being seen. The refugees would remain in hiding as long as possible, then Jenya and Zoya would get them to the harbor. Be prepared for a fight, Matthias said. The Shu will be watching this sector of town. They haven't had the temerity to attack the embassy or the marketplace yet, but it's only a matter of time.
We'll be ready, Fjaden,
said Zoya, and in her gaze he saw the steel of a born commander. On their way out of the embassy, Nina found the golden-eyed Heartrender, who had been part of the ambush at the tavern. She was Shu, with a short crop of black hair, and wore a pair of slender silver axes at her hips. Nina had told him she was the only Korporalnik among the Grisha refugees and diplomats.
Tamar?
Nina said tentatively.
If the Kurgud come, you mustn't allow yourself to be taken. A Heartrender in Shu possession and under the influence of Parem could irrevocably tip the scales in their favor. You cannot imagine the power of this drug.
No one will take me alive, said the girl.
She slid a tiny, pale yellow tablet from her pocket, displaying it between her fingers.
Poison? Jenya's own creation. It kills instantly. We all have them.
She handed it to Nina.
Take it, just in case. I have another.
Nina, Matthias said. But Nina didn't hesitate. She slipped the pill into the pocket of her skirt before Matthias could speak another word of protest. They made their way out of the government sector, steering clear of the market stalls and keeping well away from the tavern where the Stadtwatch had gathered. Matthias told himself to be alert, to focus on getting them back to Black Vale safely, but he could not stop thinking about that pale yellow pill. The sight of it had brought the dream back as vivid as ever, the ice of the north, Nina lost, and Matthias powerless to save her. It had burned the unchecked joy of her kiss right out of him. The dream had started on the ship, when Nina was in the worst throes of her struggle with Parem. She'd been in a rage that night, body quaking, clothes soaked through with sweat. You're not a good man, she'd shouted. You're a good soldier, and the sad thing is you don't even know the difference. She'd been miserable later, weeping, sick with hunger, sick with regret. I'm sorry, she'd said. I didn't mean it. You know I didn't mean it. And, a moment later, if you would just help me. Her beautiful eyes were full of tears, and in the faint light from the lantern, her pale skin had seemed gilded in frost. Please, Matthias, I'm in so much pain. Help me. He would have done anything, traded anything to ease her suffering. But he'd sworn he would not give her more Parem. He'd made a vow that he would not let her become a slave to the drug. And he had to honor it, no matter what it cost him. I can't, my love, he'd whispered, pressing a cold towel to her brow. I can't get you more Parem. I had them lock the door from the outside. In a flash, her face changed, her eyes slitted. Then break the fucking door down, you useless skiv. No. She spat in his face. Hours later, she'd been quiet, her energy spent, sad but coherent. She'd lain on her side, her eyelids a bruised shade of violet, breath coming in shallow pants, and said,
Talk to me.
About what?
About anything. Tell me about the Isenulf.
He shouldn't have been surprised she knew of the Isenulf, the white wolves bred to go into battle with the Druskala. They were bigger than ordinary wolves, and though they were trained to obey their masters, they never lost the wild, indomitable streak that separated them from their distant, domesticated cousins. It had been hard to think about Fjerda, the life he'd left behind for good, but he made himself speak, eager for any way to distract her. Sometimes there are more wolves than Druskala. Sometimes more Druskala than wolves. The wolves decide when to mate, with little influence from the breeder. They're too stubborn for that. Nina had smiled, then winced in pain.
Keep going, she whispered.
The same family has been breeding the Isenulf for generations. They live far north near Stenrink, the Ring of Stones. When a new litter arrives, we travel there by foot and by sledge, and each Druskala chooses a pup. From then on, you are each other's responsibility. You fight beside each other, sleep on the same furs. Your rations are your wolf's rations. He is not your pet. He is a warrior like you. A brother. Nina shivered, and Matthias felt a sick rush of shame. In a battle with Grisha, The Isanulf could help even the odds for a Druskala, trained to come to his aid and tear out his attacker's throat. Heartrender power seemed to have no effect on animals. A Grisha, like Nina, would be virtually helpless under Isanulf attack.
What if something happens to the wolf?
Nina asked. A Druskala can train a new wolf, but it is a terrible loss.
What happens to the wolf if his Druskala is killed?
Matthias was silent for a time. He did not want to think about this. Tras had been the creature of his heart. They are returned to the wild, but they will never be accepted by any pack. And what was a wolf without a pack? The Isanulf were not meant to live alone. And when had other Druskala decided Matthias was dead? Had it been Broom who had taken Tras north to the ice? The idea of his wolf left alone, howling for Matthias to come and take him home, carved a hollow ache in his chest. It felt like something had broken there and left an echo, the lonely snap of a branch too heavy with snow. As if she had sensed his sorrow, Nina opened her eyes, the pale green of a bud about to unfurl, a color that brought him back from the ice.
What was his name?
Trassel. The corner of her lips tilted.
Troublemaker.
No one else wanted him.
Was he a runt?
No, Matthias said. The opposite. It had taken more than a week of hard travel to reach the Ring of Stones. Matthias hadn't enjoyed the trip. He'd been 12 years old, new to the Druskala, and every day he'd thought about running away. He didn't mind the training. The hours spent running and sparring helped to keep the longing he felt for his family at bay. He wanted to be an officer. He wanted to fight Grisha. He wanted a chance to bring honor to the memory of his parents and his sister. The Druskala had given him purpose. But the rest of it? The jokes in the mess hall? The endless boasting and mindless chatter? That he had no use for. He had a family. They were buried beneath the black earth, their souls gone to gel. The Druskala were merely a means to an end. Broom had warned him he would never become a true Druskala if he did not learn to see other boys as his brothers. But Matthias didn't believe that. He was the biggest, the strongest, the fastest. He didn't need to be popular to survive. He'd ridden in the back of the sled for the entirety of the journey, huddled in his furs, speaking to no one. And when they'd finally arrived at the Ring of Stones, he'd hung back. Unsure of himself as other Druskala bolted into the big barn, yelling and shoving one another, each of them diving for the pile of wriggling white wolf pups with their ice-chip eyes. The truth was that he wanted a wolf pup desperately, but he knew there might not be enough for all of them. It was up to the breeder which boy was paired with each pup and who went home empty-handed. Many of the boys were already talking to the old woman, attempting to charm her.
You see? This one likes me. Look, look! I got her to sit.
Matthias knew he should try to be personable, make some kind of effort, but instead he found himself drawn to the kennels in the back of the barn. In the corner, in a wire cage, he caught a yellow flash, light reflecting off a pair of wary eyes. He drew closer and saw a wolf, a pup no longer, but not yet full grown. He growled as Matthias drew closer to the cage, hackles raised, head lowered, teeth bared. The young wolf had a long scar across his muzzle. It had cut across his right eye and changed part of the iris from blue to mottled brown.
"Don't want no business with that one," said the breeder.
Matthias didn't know when she'd snuck up behind him.
"Can he see?"
"He can, but he don't like people."
"Why not?"
"He got out when he was still a pup. Made it across 2 miles of ice fields. Kid found him and cut him up with a broken bottle. Won't let no one near him since, and he's getting too old to train. Probably have to put him down soon."
"Let me take him."
"He'd just as soon tear you to bits as let you feed him, boy. We'll have a pup for you next time."
As soon as the woman walked away, Matthias opened the cage. And just as fast, the wolf lunged forward and bit him. Matthias wanted to scream as the wolf's teeth sank into his forearm. He toppled to the ground, the wolf on top of him, the pain beyond anything he'd ever known. But he did not make a sound. He held the wolf's gaze as its teeth sank more deeply into the muscle of his arm, a growl rumbling through the animal's chest. Matthias suspected that the wolf's jaws were strong enough to break bone, but he did not struggle, did not cry out, did not drop his gaze. "I won't hurt you," he swore, "even if you hurt me." A long moment passed, and then another. Matthias could feel blood soaking through his sleeve. He thought he might lose consciousness. Then, slowly, the wolf's jaws released. The animal sat back, the white fur of his muzzle coated in Matthias's blood. Head tilted to one side, the wolf released a huff of breath.
"Nice to meet you, too," said Matthias.
He sat up cautiously, bandaged his arm with the bottom of his shirt, and then he and his wolf, both covered in blood, walked back to where the others were playing in a pile of wolf pups and gray uniforms.
"This one's mine," he said, as they all turned to stare, and the old woman shook her head.
Then, Matthias passed out. That night, on the ship, Matthias had told Nina about Trassel, his fierce nature, his ragged scar. Eventually, she had dozed, and Matthias had let himself shut his eyes. The ice was waiting. The killing wind came with white teeth. The wolves howled in the distance, and Nina cried out, but Matthias could not go to her. The dream had come every night since. It was hard not to see it as some kind of omen. And when Nina had casually dropped that yellow pill into her pocket, it had been like watching the storm come on, the roar of the wind filling his ears, the cold burrowing into his bones. The certainty that he was going to lose her.
"Parem might not work on you anymore," he said now.
They'd finally reached the deserted canal where they'd moored the gondola.
"What?"
"Your power has changed, hasn't it?" Nina's footsteps faltered.
"Yes."
"Because of the Parem?"
Now Nina stopped.
"Why are you asking me this?"
He didn't want to ask her. He wanted to kiss her again. But he said,
"If you were captured, the shoe might not be able to use the drug to enslave you."
"Or it could be just as bad as before."
"That pill, the poison Tamar gave you."
Nina laid a hand on his arm.
"I'm not going to be captured, Matthias."
"But if you were?"
"I don't know what the Parem did to me. I have to believe the effects will wear off in time."
"And if they don't?"
"They have to,"
she said, brow furrowed.
"I can't live like this. It's like being only half of myself. Although..."
"Although?" he urged.
"The craving isn't quite so bad right now," she said, as if realizing it herself. "In fact, I've barely thought of Parem since the fight at the tavern."
"Using this new power helped?"
"Maybe,"
she said cautiously.
"And..."
she frowned. Matthias heard a low, curling growl.
"Was that your stomach?"
"It was."
Nina's face split in a dazzling grin.
"Matthias, I'm famished."
Could she truly be healing at last? Or had what she'd done at the tavern returned her appetite to her? He didn't care. He was just glad she was smiling that way. He picked her up and spun her in the air.
"You're going to strain something if you keep doing that," she said, with another radiant smile.
"You're light as a feather."
"I do not want to see that bird. Now, let's go get me a stack of waffles twice as tall as you. I..."
She broke off, the color draining from her face.
"Oh, saints."
Matthias followed her gaze over his shoulder and found himself looking into his own eyes. A poster had been plastered to the wall, emblazoned with a scarily accurate sketch of his face. Above and beside the illustration, written in several different languages, a single word. "Wanted." Nina snatched the poster from the wall.
"You were supposed to be dead."
"Someone must have asked to see Muzzin's body before it was burned.
Maybe the Fjerdens. Maybe just someone at the prison. There were more words printed at the bottom in Kurtz that Matthias couldn't read, but he understood his own name and the number well enough.
50,000 Kruger. They're offering a reward for my capture.
No,
Nina said. She pointed to the text beneath the large number and translated.
Wanted, Matthias Helvar. Dead or alive. They've put a price on your head.
16. Jesper. When Nina and Matthias came charging into the tomb, Jesper wanted to leap up from the table and waltz with them both. He'd spent the last hour trying to explain to Kuwe how they would reach the embassy, and he was starting to get the distinct impression the kid was playing dumb. Possibly because he was enjoying the ridiculous gestures Jesper was making.
Could you repeat the last part?
Kuwe said now, leaning in a little too close. Nina, Jesper said, can you help facilitate this exchange?
Thank the saints,
said Inej, leaving off her work at the table with Wylan and Kaz. They were assembling the mass of wires and gear Kaz had stolen from the circus Zerkoa. Wylan had spent the last 2 hours making modifications to ensure Inej's safety at the silos, attaching magnetized clamps that would grip their metal sides.
Why do you keep staring at him?
Kuwe said.
I look just like him. You could look at me.
I'm not staring at him, protested Jesper. I'm overseeing their work. The sooner Kuwe got on that boat, the better. The tomb was starting to feel crowded.
Did you manage to contact the refugees?
Inej asked, waving Nina over to the table and clearing a place for her to sit.
Everything went smoothly, said Nina, aside from breaking a few windows and nearly getting shot.
Kaz looked up from the table, his interest secured. Big trouble in Little Ravka? Asked Jesper.
Nothing we couldn't handle, Nina said.
Please tell me there's something to eat.
You're hungry, said Inej.
They all goggled at Nina. She curtsied.
Yes, yes, Nina Zenik is hungry. Now will someone feed me before I'm forced to cook one of you?
Don't be ridiculous, said Jesper. You don't know how to cook. Inej was already digging through what remained of their stockpile of food, placing the meager offerings of salt cod, dried meat, and stale crackers before Nina.
What happened at the tavern? Asked Kaz.
The refugees are in hiding at the embassy, said Matthias.
We met their leader, said Nina.
They'll be waiting for word from us. She shoved two crackers into her mouth.
These are awful.
Slow down, said Matthias. You're going to choke.
Worth it,
Nina said, struggling to swallow.
For crackers?
I'm pretending they're pie. When does the boat leave?
We found a shipment of molasses headed for Os Curvo, leaving at 11 bells, said Inej.
Spect is working on the documents now.
Good,
said Nina, uncrumpling a piece of paper from her pocket and smoothing it onto the table. A sketch of Matthias looked back at them.
We need to get out of town as soon as possible.
Damn it,
Jesper said. Kaz and Wylan are still in the lead. He gestured to where they'd pasted up the rest of the wanted posters. Jesper, Kaz, and Inej were all there. Vanek hadn't yet dared to plaster Kuwe Yulbo's face over every surface in Ketterdom. But he'd had to maintain the pretense of searching for his son, so there was also a poster offering a reward for Wylan Vanek's safe return. It showed his old features, but Jesper didn't think it was much of a likeness. Only Nina was missing. She'd never met Vanek, and though she had connections to the dregs, it was possible he didn't know of her involvement. Matthias examined the posters.
100,000 Kruger,
He shot a disbelieving glower at Kaz. You're hardly worth that. The hint of a smile tugged at Kaz's lips. As the market wills it. Tell me about it, said Jesper. They're only offering 30,000 for me.
Your lives are at stake, said Wylan. How can you act like this is a competition?
We're stuck in a tomb, Merchling. You take the action where you find it.
Maybe we should all go to Ravka, said Nina, tapping Inez's wanted poster. It isn't safe for you to remain here.
It's not a bad idea, said Kaz. Inez cast him a swift glance.
You'd go to Ravka?
Not a chance. I'll lie low here. I want to see Vanek's life come apart when the hammer falls.
But you could come, Nina said to Inez. Jesper?
We could bring Colm, too.
Jesper thought of his father, stuck in some lavish suite at the Geldrenner, probably wearing the carpet down to the floorboards with his pacing.
Just 2 days had passed since he'd watched his father's broad back disappear between the graves as Rotti shepherded him off Black Vale, but it felt like far longer. Since then, Jesper had nearly been killed by Grisha hunters and had a price placed on his head. But if they could just get this job done tonight, his father wouldn't have to know any of that. No way, said Jesper. I want Dahl to get his money as fast as possible and then get back to Novye Zim. I'm not going to sleep easy until he's safe on the farm. We'll hide out at his hotel until Van Eck has been discredited and the sugar market goes crazy.
Inez? Said Nina.
They all looked to the wraith, except Jesper. He watched Kaz, curious to see how he would react to the prospect of Inez leaving town. But Kaz's expression was impassive, as if waiting to hear what time dinner might be served. Inez shook her head. When I go to Ravka, it will be on my own ship, piloted by my own crew. Jesper's brows shot up. Since when are you a seafarer? And what sane person would want to spend more time on a boat? Inez smiled. I've heard this city drives people mad. Kaz drew his watch from his waistcoat. We're coming up on 8 bells. Van Eck is gathering the merchant council at his house for a meeting tonight.
Do you think they'll devote more resources to the search for Wylan? Asked Nina.
Probably. It's not our concern anymore. The noise and people coming and going will provide good cover for Wylan and me to get the seal out of the safe. Nina and Inez will hit the sweet reef at the same time. The guards patrol the silo's perimeter constantly, and it takes about 12 minutes for them to make it around the fence. They always leave someone to watch the gate, so be smart about the approach. He placed a tiny stoppered bottle on the table. This is coffee extract. Kuwe, Nina, Jesper, I want you all wearing plenty of it. If those shoe soldiers really can scent Grisha, this might throw them off.
Coffee?
Asked Kuwe, popping the cork and taking a tentative sniff.
Clever, said Jesper.
We used to pack illegal shipments of Gerda and spices in coffee grounds to throw off the Stardwatch dogs, confuses their noses. Nina took the bottle and dabbed a generous amount of the extract behind her ears and at her wrists. Let's hope the Kurgood work the same way.
Your refugees had better be ready, said Kaz. How many are there?
Fewer than we thought. 15 and, some of the people from the embassy, too. A total of 17.
Plus you, Matthias, Wyland, and Kuwe. 21. Spect will forge the letter accordingly.
I'm not going, said Wylan.
Jesper clasped his fingers together to make them stay still.
No.
I'm not letting my father run me out of the city again.
Why is everyone so determined to stay in this miserable town?
Nina grumbled.
Jesper tipped his chair back, studying Kaz.
He'd shown no surprise that Wylan wanted to remain in Ketterdam.
You knew, he said, putting the pieces together.
You knew Weiland's mother was alive. Weiland's mother is alive? Said Nina.
Why do you think I let you two go to Olendal? Kaz said. Weiland blinked.
And you knew I was lying about the quarry?
Jesper felt a spike of rage. It was one thing for Kaz to mess with him, but Weiland wasn't like the rest of them. Despite the bad hand he'd drawn with his father, Weiland hadn't let his circumstances or this city knock the goodness out of him. He still believed people could do right. Jesper pointed a finger at Kaz. You shouldn't have sent him to St. Hilda blind like that. It was cruel. It was necessary. Weiland's fists were clenched.
Why?
Because you still didn't understand what your father really is.
You could have told me.
You were angry. Angry wears off. I need you righteous. Weiland crossed his arms.
Well, you've got me.
Kaz folded his hands over his cane. It's getting late, so everybody put away your poor Weiland hankies and set your minds to the task at hand. Matthias, Jesper, and Kue will leave for the embassy at 9:30. You approach from the canal. Jesper, you're tall, brown, and conspicuous. All synonyms for delightful. And that means you'll have to be twice as careful. There's always a price to be paid for greatness. Try to take this seriously, said Kaz, voice like a rusty blade. Was that actual concern? Jesper tried not to wonder if it was for him or the job. Move quickly and get everyone to the docks no sooner than 10. I don't want all of you hanging around attracting attention. We meet at 3rd Harbor, berth 15. The ship is called the Verhader. It sails the route from Kerch to Ravka several times a year. He rose. Stay smart and stay quiet. None of this works if Van Eck gets wise. And stay safe, added Inej. I want to celebrate with all of you when the boat leaves the harbor. Jesper wanted that too. He wants to see them all safe on the other side of this night. He raised his hand. Will there be champagne? Nina finished the last of the crackers, licking her fingers. I'll be there, and I'm effervescent. After that, there was nothing to do but finish packing up their gear. There would be no grand goodbye. Jesper shuffled over to the table where Weiland was packing his satchel and pretended to search for something he needed in the pile of maps and documents. He hesitated, then said, You could stay with me and Dar if you want at the hotel, if you need a place to wait everything out.
Really?
Sure, Jesper said with a shrug that didn't feel right on his shoulders. Inej and Kaz, too. We can't all scatter before the comeuppance is delivered.
And after that, when your father's loan is paid, will you go back to Novia Zem?
I should.
Weiland waited. Jesper didn't have an answer for him.
If he went back to the farm, he'd be away from the temptations of Ketterdam and the barrel.
But he might just find some new kind of trouble to get into.
And there would be so much money. Even after the loan was paid, there would still be more than 3 million kruger.
He shrugged again.
Kaz is the planner.
Sure, said Weiland. But Jesper could see the disappointment in his face.
I suppose you've got your future all figured out.
No, I just know I'm going to get my mother out of that place and try to build some kind of life for us.
Weiland nodded to the posters on the wall.
Is this really what you want? To be a criminal, to keep bouncing from the next score, to the next fight, to the next near miss?
Honestly? Jesper knew Weiland probably wasn't going to like what he said next. It's time, Kaz said from the doorway. Yes, this is what I want, said Jesper.
Weiland looped his satchel over his shoulder, and without thinking, Jesper reached out and untwisted the strap.
He didn't let go, but it's not all I want. Now, said Kaz, I'm going to beat him over the head with that cane.
Jesper released the strap.
No mourners.
No funerals,
Weiland said quietly. He and Kaz vanished through the door.
Nina and Inej were next. Nina had disappeared into one of the passages to change out of the ridiculous Fjerdin costume and don practical trousers, coat, and tunic. All of Rav can make and cut. She'd taken Matthias with her and had emerged rumpled and rosy several long minutes later.
Staying on task? Jesper couldn't resist asking.
I'm teaching Matthias all about fun.
He's an excellent student, diligent in his lessons. Nina, Matthias warned.
He has problems with attitude, shows room for improvement.
Inej nudged the bottle of coffee extract toward Jesper. Try to be cautious tonight, Jess. I'm about as good at cautious as Matthias is at fun. I'm perfectly good at fun, Matthias growled.
Perfectly,
Jesper agreed. There was more he wanted to say to all of them, mostly Inej, but not in front of the others. Maybe not ever, he conceded. He owed Inej an apology. His carelessness had gotten them ambushed at Fifth Harbor before they left for the ice court job, and the mistake had nearly cost the Wraith her life. But how the hell did you apologize for that?
Sorry, I almost got you stabbed to death.
Who wants waffles? Before he could ponder it further, Inej had planted a kiss on his cheek. Nina had aimed a single-fingered gesture at the wall of wanted posters, and Jesper was stuck waiting for 9:30 bells, alone in the tomb with a glum-looking Kuwe and a pacing Matthias. Kuwe began reorganizing the notebooks in his pack. Jesper sat down at the table.
Do you need all of those?
I do, said Kuwe. Have you been to Ravka?
Poor kid is scared, thought Jesper.
No,
but you'll have Nina and Matthias with you. Kuwe glanced at Matthias and whispered,
He is very stern.
Jesper had to laugh. He's not what I call a party, but he has a few good qualities.
I can hear you, Fahey,
Matthias grumbled.
Good. I'd hate to have to shout.
Aren't you even concerned about the others? Matthias said.
Of course. But all of us are out of nursery clothes. The time for worrying is over.
Now we get to the fun part, he said, tapping his guns. The doing.
Or the dying, Matthias muttered.
You know, as well as I do, that Nina isn't at her best.
She doesn't have to be tonight.
The whole idea is not to get into a fight. Alas.
Matthias left off his prowling and took a seat at the table across from Jesper.
What happened at the lake house?
Jesper smoothed out the corner of one of the maps.
I'm not sure, but I think she choked a guy to death with a cloud of dust.
I don't understand it, said Matthias. A cloud of dust? She controlled shards of bone today. She could never have done that before Parem.
She seems to think the change is temporary, a residual effect of the drug, but...
He turned to Kuwe. Could the Parem alter Agrisha's power? Change it? Destroy it? Kuwe fiddled with the latch on his travel pack. I suppose it's possible. She survived the withdrawal. That is rare. And we know so little about Parem, about Grisha power.
Didn't carve enough open to solve that riddle?
The words were out of Jesper's mouth before he thought better of them. He knew they weren't fair.
Kuwe and his father were Grisha themselves, and neither had been in any position to keep the shoe from experimenting on others.
You are angry with me, said Kuwe.
Jesper smiled.
I'm not an angry type of guy.
Yes, you are, said Matthias. Angry and frightened.
Jesper sized up the big Fjerdin.
Beg your pardon.
Jesper is very brave, protested Kuwe.
Thank you for noticing.
Jesper stretched out his legs and crossed one ankle over the other. You have something to say, Matthias.
Why aren't you going to Ravka?
My father...
Your father could go with us tonight.
And if you are so concerned about him, why weren't you at his hotel today?
I don't see how that's any of your business. I know what it is to be ashamed of what you are, of what you've done. You really want to start this, Witch Hunter? I'm not ashamed. I'm careful. Thanks to people like you and your Driscoll buddies, the world is a dangerous place for people like me. It always has been, and it doesn't look to be getting any better. Kuei reached out and touched Jesper's hand, his face imploring. Understand, please. What we did, what my father did, we were trying to make things better. To make a way for Grisha to... He made a gesture as if he was pressing something down.
To suppress their powers? Suggested Matthias.
Yes. Exactly. To hide more easily. If Grisha don't use their powers, they grow ill. They age, tire easily, lose appetite. It's one way the Shu identify Grisha trying to live in secret.
I don't use my power, said Jesper. And yet, he held up his fingers, enumerating his points as he made them. One, on a dare, I ate a literal trough full of waffles doused in apple syrup and almost went back for seconds. Two, a lack of energy has never been my problem. Three, I've never been sick a day in my life.
No, said Matthias.
There are many kinds of sickness.
Jesper touched his hands to his revolvers. Apparently the Fjerdin had a lot on his mind tonight.
Kuei opened his pack and took out a tin of ordinary Jurda, the kind sold in every corner shop in Ketterdam.
Jurda is a stimulant, good for fighting fatigue. My father thought it was the answer to helping our kind. If he can find the right formula, it will allow Grisha to remain healthy while hiding their powers.
Didn't quite work out that way, did it? Jesper said. Maybe he was a little angry.
The tests do not go as planned.
Someone in the laboratory is loose in his talk. Our leaders find out and see a different destiny for Parim.
He shook his head and gestured to his pack. Now I try to remember my father's experiments.
That's what you're scribbling away at in the notebooks?
I also keep a journal.
Must be fascinating. Day one, sat in tomb. Day two, sat in tomb some more.
Matthias ignored Jesper and said, Have you had any success?
Kuei frowned.
Some, I think. In a laboratory with real scientists, maybe more. I'm not my father. He was a fabricator. I am an Inferni. This is not what I'm good at.
What are you good at?
Asked Jesper. Kuei cast him a speculative glance, then frowned.
I never had a chance to find out. We live a frightened life in Shuhan. It was never home.
That was certainly something Jesper could understand. He picked up the tin of Jurda and popped the lid open. It was quality stuff, sweetly scented, the dried blossoms nearly whole, and a vibrant orange color.
You think, if you have a lab and a few Grisha fabricators around, you might be able to recreate your father's experiments and somehow work your way to an antidote?
I hope, said Kuei.
How would it work? Would it purge the body of Parim? Asked Matthias.
Yes, draw the Parim out, said Kuei. But, even if we succeed, how to administer it?
You'd have to get close enough to inject it, or make someone swallow it, said Matthias. And by the time you were within range, you'd be done for, finished Jesper.
Jesper pinched one of the Jurda blossoms between his fingers. Eventually, someone would figure out how to create their own version of Jurda Parim. And when they did, one of these blossoms might be worth a very pretty fortune.
If he focused on its petals, even a little, he could feel them breaking apart into their smaller components. It wasn't exactly seeing. More like
sensing all the different, tiny bits of matter that formed a single whole. He put the flower back in the tin. When he was a little boy, lying in his father's fields, he'd discovered he could leach the color out of a gerda blossom petal by petal. One boring afternoon, he'd bleached a swear word into the western pasture in capital letters. His father had been furious, but he'd been scared too. He'd yelled himself hoarse, chastising Jesper. And then, Colm had just sat there, staring at him, big hands clasped around a mug of tea to keep them from shaking. At first, Jesper thought it was the swear his father was mad about, but that wasn't it at all. "Jess," he'd said at last, "you must never do that again. Promise me. Your ma had the same gift. It can bring you only misery. Promise," Jesper had said quickly, wanting to make things right, still reeling from seeing his patient, mild-mannered father in such a rage. But all he'd thought was, Ma didn't seem miserable. In fact, his mother had seemed to take joy in everything. She was Zemini-born, her skin a deep, plummy brown, and so tall his father had to tilt his head back to look her in the eye. Before Jesper was old enough to work the fields with his father, he'd been allowed to stay home with her. There was always laundry to be done, food to be made, wood to be chopped, and Jesper loved to help her. "How's my land?" she'd ask every day when his father returned from the fields. And later, Jesper would learn that the farm had been in her name, a wedding gift from his father, who had courted a D.T. Healy for nearly a year before she'd deigned to give him the time of day. "Blooming," he'd say, kissing her cheek. "Just like you, love." Jesper's da always promised to play with him and teach him to whittle at night. But invariably, Colm would eat his dinner and fall asleep by the fire, boots still on, their soles stained orange with gerda. Jesper and his mother would pull them off Da's feet, stifling their giggles, then cover him with a blanket and see to the rest of the evening's chores. They'd clear the table and bring the laundry in off the line, and she'd tuck Jesper into bed. No matter how busy she got, no matter how many animals needed skinning or baskets needed mending, she seemed to have the same infinite energy as Jesper, and she always had time to tell him a story before bed or hum him a song. Jesper's mother was the one to teach him to ride a horse, bait a line, clean a fish, pluck a quail, to start a fire with nothing but two sticks, and to brew a proper cup of tea. And she taught him to shoot. First, with a child's pellet gun that was little more than a toy. Then, with pistols and rifle. "Anyone can shoot," she told him. "But not everybody can aim." She taught him distance sighting, how to track an animal through the brush, the tricks that light can play on your eyes, how to factor wind shear, and how to shoot running. Then, seated on a horse, there was nothing she couldn't do. There were secret lessons, too. Sometimes, when they got home late, and she needed to get supper on, she'd boil the water without ever heating the stove, make bread rise just by looking at it. He'd seen her pull stains from clothes with a brush of her fingers, and she made her own gunpowder, extracting the saltpeter from a long, dry lake bed near where they lived. "Why pay for something I can make better myself?" she asked. "But we don't mention this to Da, When Jesper asked why, she'd just say, "Because he has enough to worry about, and I don't like it when he worries about me." But Da did worry, especially when one of his mother's Zemini friends came to the door looking for help or healing. "You think the slavers can't reach you here?" he'd ask one night,
pacing back and forth in their cabin as Jesper huddled in his blankets, pretending to sleep so that he could listen.
If word gets out there's a Grisha living here.
That word, Aditi said, with a wave of one of her graceful hands, is not our word. I cannot be anything other than what I am. And if my gifts can help people, then it's my duty to use them. And what about our son? Do you owe him nothing? Your first duty is to stay safe so we don't lose you. But Jesper's mother had taken Colm's face in her hands, so gently, so kindly, with all the love shining from her eyes. What kind of mother would I be to my son if I hid away my talents? If I let fear be my guide in this life? You knew what I was when you asked that I choose you, Colm. Do not now suggest that I be anything less. And like that, his father's frustration was gone. I know. I just can't bear the thought of losing you. She laughed and kissed him. Then you must keep me close, she said with a wink. And the argument would be over. Until the next one. As it turned out, Jesper's father was wrong. They didn't lose Aditi to slavers. Jesper woke one night to hear voices, and when he'd wriggled out from under his blankets, he'd seen his mother putting her coat over her long nightgown, fetching a hat and her boots. He'd been 7 then, small for his age, but old enough to know the most interesting conversations happened after his bedtime. A Zemini man stood at the door in dusty riding clothes, and his father was saying, "It's the middle of the night. Surely this can wait until morning." "If it were Jess who lay suffering, would you say that?" asked his mother. "Aditi." She'd kissed Colm's cheek, then swept Jesper up in her arms. "Is my little rabbit awake?" "No," he said. "Well then, you must be dreaming." She tucked him back in, kissed his cheeks and his forehead. "Go to sleep, little rabbit, and I'll be back tomorrow." But she didn't return the next day, and when a knock came the following morning, it was not his mother, just the same dusty Zemini man. Colm grabbed his son and was out the door in moments. He pushed a hat onto his head, plunked Jesper down in the saddle in front of him, then kicked his horse into a gallop. The dusty man rode an even dustier horse, and they followed him across miles of cultivated land to a white farmhouse at the edge of a Jurta field. It was far nicer than their little cabin, 2 stories high, with glass in the windows. The woman, sitting at the door, was stouter than his mother, but nearly as tall. Her hair piled in thick coils of braids. She waved them inside, saying, "She's upstairs." In the years after, when Jesper had pieced together what had happened over those terrible days, he remembered very few things. The polished wood floors of the farmhouse and how they felt nearly silky beneath his fingers. The stout woman's eyes, red from crying. And the girl, a child several years older than Jesper, with braids like her mother's. The girl had drunk from a well that had been dug too near one of the mines. It was supposed to be boarded up, but someone had simply taken away the bucket. The winch was still there, and the old rope. So the girl and her friends had used one of their lunch pails to bring the water up, cold as morning and twice as clear. All 3 of them had taken ill that night. 2 of them had died. But Jesper's mother had saved the girl, the stout woman's daughter. Aditi had come to the girl's bedside, sniffed the metal lunch pail, then set her hands to the girl's fevered skin. By noon the next day, the fever had broken, and the yellowish tinge was gone from the girl's eyes. By early evening, she sat up and told her mother she was hungry. Aditi smiled once at her and collapsed. "She didn't take enough care when extracting the poison," the dusty man said. "She absorbed too much of it herself. I've seen it happen before with Zawa." Zawa. It simply meant blessed. That was the word Jesper's mother used instead of Grisha.
We are Zawa, she would say to Jesper as she made a flower bloom with the flick of her fingers. You and me. Now, there was no one to call upon to save her. Jesper did not know how. If she'd been conscious, if she'd been stronger, she might have been able to heal herself. Instead, she slipped away into some deep dream, her breath becoming more and more labored. Jesper slept, his cheek pressed to his mother's palm, sure that any minute she would wake and stroke his cheek, and he would hear her voice say, "What are you doing here, little rabbit?" Instead, he woke to the sound of his father, weeping. They'd taken her back to the farm and buried her beneath a cherry tree that was already beginning to flower. To Jesper, it had seemed too pretty for such a sad day, and even now, seeing those pale pink flowers in a shop window, or embroidered on a lady's silks, always put him in a melancholy mind. They took him back to the smell of fresh-turned earth, the wind whispering through the fields, his father's trembling baritone singing a lonely kind of song, a Kalish air in words Jesper didn't understand. When Colm had finished, the last notes drifting up into the cherry tree's branches, Jesper said, "Was Ma a witch?" Colm laid a freckled hand on his son's shoulder and drew him close. "She was a queen, Jess," he said. "She was our queen." Jesper had made dinner for them that night, burnt biscuits and watery soup. But his father ate every bite and read to him from his Kalish Book of Saints until the lights burned low and the pain in Jesper's heart eased enough for him to sleep. And that was the way it had been from then on. The two of them, looking after each other, working the fields, bundling and drying Gerda in the summers, trying to make the farm pay. Why hadn't it been enough? But even as Jesper had the thought, he knew it could never be enough. He could never go back to that life. He hadn't been built for it. Maybe, if his mother had lived, she would have taught him to channel his restlessness. Maybe she would have shown him how to use his power instead of hiding it. Maybe he'd have gone to Ravka to be a soldier for the crown. Or maybe he would have ended up right here anyway. He wiped the stain of the Gerda from his fingertips and placed the lid back on the tin.
"The Zemini don't just use the blossoms," he said. "I remember my mother soaking Gerda stalks in goat's milk. She gave it to me when I'd been out in the fields." "Why?" asked Matthias. "To counteract the effects of inhaling Gerda pollen all day. It's too much for a child's system, and no one wanted me more excitable than I already was."
"The stalks?" repeated Kuwe. "Most people just dispose of them."
"The stalks have a balm in them. The Zemini drain it for ointments. They rub it on babies' gums and nostrils when they're burning Gerda."
Jesper's fingers drumming on the tin. A thought forming in his mind.
Could the secret to the antidote for Gerda Perim be the Gerda plant itself?
He wasn't a chemist. He didn't think like Wylan, and he hadn't been trained as a fabricator. But he was his mother's son.
"What if there's a version of the balm that would counteract the effects of Gerda Perim?"
"There still wouldn't be a way to admit that," was when the window shattered.
Jesper had his guns drawn in less than a breath as Matthias shoved Kuwe down and shouldered his rifle.
They edged to the wall, and Jesper peeked outside through the smashed, stained glass. In the shadows of the cemetery, he saw lanterns raised, shifting shapes that had to be people. A lot of people.
"Unless the ghost just got a lot more lively," Jesper said. "It looks like we have company."
Part 4. The Unexpected Visitor. 17. Inej. At night, the warehouse district felt like it had shed its skin and taken on a new form. The shanty towns at its eastern edges crackled with life, while the streets of the district itself became a no-man's land, occupied only by guards at their posts and Stadwatch grunts walking their beats. Inej and Nina moored their boat in the wide central